Alright guys, so it took us almost 50 episodes, but we finally made it. Our first truly problematic favorite book. It's colonialism from the British perspective. But don't worry, our guest knows more about this topic than I ever could, and we add in some really interesting nuance. Welcome to Your Favorite Book. This week's guest is Amrita. She's the host of the BookTube channel Amrita by the Book and co-host of the Khandan Bollywood podcast. Amrita, how are you today?
I'm very well. Thank you for asking and thank you for inviting me on your show.
I'm so excited to have you on this show. You know, I first heard you on our mutual friend Emily from Fuckboys of Lit. I heard you on that show and I was so happy that you brought Indian literature to that show, and I was like, I need to have Amrita on my show. And then I found all of the things that you're doing related to books and movies, and I'm so excited for this conversation.
Me too. I was so glad when you reached out because I love your show. Like, I've been listening to quite a few, you know, episodes of your show as well, and when you reached out I was like, what? Yes, I want to talk about my favorite book.
Yes. And so before we get to the book itself, and there's so much to talk about for this book, I have a few things to ask you. So I've had podcasters, bloggers, writers on the show, but you're actually my first BookTuber. So I've always been super intimidated by YouTube, you know, being on camera and having to deal with all that. And how do you feel about YouTube as a platform for your content?
I think if it was like a big YouTube channel, like if I was approaching it as something that I wanted to do full time as a job, I think I would have approached it very differently and I would have very different feelings about it. But as it is, what I describe it as a pandemic channel, in that I was in lockdown in India. Couldn't leave my apartment and I was going slowly insane. And I was like, I need more social interaction than my friends can provide over Zoom. So I need to just reach out a little bit. I never knew that I was that social as a person until I was forced to just stay in this apartment. So that's how the YouTube channel began. It was just me being like, I am just going to put out these 12 videos. And I'm just going to give people recommendations for things that they can read in lockdown, you know, like longer works of literature, maybe series, things that I'd really like. And I'll see if I can just connect to some people, strike up conversations, just get out of my head, basically, you know, like it was just something that not even the recording of it was actually the editing of it that really appealed to me for some reason. And I don't have like a fancy setup. Like, I'm 100% like, I edit on my phone, which shocks the bejesus out of everybody that I know. They're just like, how can you do that? And I'm like, well, modern technology. But I really like it. I enjoy it. I never thought in a million years that I would become a YouTuber. Like, that was not something that was on my list. But now it's been a year, like this is actually my anniversary month. And and it's been wonderful. Like, I've met people that I normally would never have met. I've read books that I usually wouldn't even have known existed. It's been fun. And I've learned new skills, I think.
Absolutely. And so much of what you're saying reminds me back to when I started this podcast. It really was a pandemic project, you know, for me, it was sort of late summer last year. And obviously the situation in the US was different than over in India, but we were, you know, locked down to a certain extent. I wasn't able to socialize. And like you, I didn't consider myself a social person until I didn't have the option anymore. And I just found that, you know, making content and reaching out to people that way was just a great way of staying engaged in the literary world and just like talking to people. I miss that. Yeah. And so I'm also interested in your podcast. We have to talk about this. It's a premise I absolutely love. So for those of you that haven't heard Amrita's podcast, it's a Bollywood podcast, but it's primarily focused on the three main Khans of Bollywood. And these are Salman Khan, Aamir Khan, and Shah Rukh Khan. And you co-host it with a couple of other hosts. And I want to hear the origin story of this. How did this all start for you guys?
Well, it started with Asim, who was my co-host. And so it's Asim, Sujoy, and myself. And Asim has been in the podcasting field, like a proper podcaster, you know, for I think like 11, 12 years now. So he was one of the very earliest, if not the earliest, Bollywood podcaster out there. And we've known each other like socially online for years now, but I was living in London in I moved to London around 2016, and I met Asim in person then, and we just hit it off, and we became just really good friends. And he actually had this idea about a sort of nostalgia podcast where, you know, we three are 90s kids, and we would just talk about these three giants of Indian cinema who have made movies that have really influenced us over the years, and who's still making movies, by the way, like, you know, it's not past tense. They're still giant superstars, and everybody watches their films. And a lot of the memes, for example, that you'll see in the Indian online space refer back to their films, to their dialogues. Everybody knows their songs. Like, we just really grew up with these movies, and we wanted to just watch these films again and just see what it was that we connected with and how we relate to it today outside of like memes and stuff. And some of it was really great because, you know, they're just genuinely good films and you can appreciate it. And then there were others where we were like, okay, so that was clearly, you know, some kind of stardom magic, because the movie's terrible. And then there were other movies where we were just watching it and we're just like, why were we allowed to watch this as children? Because it's terrible. So it's a sort of engagement with our childhood selves, I would say, but it's also, you know, we're talking about Indian cinema as a whole. So we look at not just Bollywood cinema, but like, you know, other industries in India, because India has several, you know, movie industries in different languages, of course. And excuse me. And we just engage with all of those things and the ideas that are prevalent in Indian cinema through the lens of the movies of these three men. And it's been an interesting process, but honestly, we just do it because we just enjoy each other's company.
That it's so great. And I'm so glad that you explore cinema that isn't just Bollywood, because I think especially here in the West, we neglect that. The Indian film industry is so widespread. We have so many different languages. And we were talking about before the show, your family is based in Kerala. My family is also from Kerala. Obviously, Malayalam cinema is such a big deal and such a thriving. And honestly, a lot of Bollywood movies are getting their ideas from South Indian cinema. Like,
definitely.
So, yes. And I have to ask you a question that I'm sure you've gotten before, but can you pick a favorite out of the three Khans?
People have asked me that. And it's always difficult for me, but I would say, if we're talking just on the basis of movies, I would probably say, like, in the past 10 years or so, Aamir has made like probably some of the best movies. But I would say as an actor, I really enjoy Shah Rukh more than any of the other two. Just because he's always been a bit more experimental. His masculine energy has been a little bit different from the usual that we see in Bollywood. I really like the fact that he continues to experiment as much as he can within the cage of his stardom. And sometimes it really doesn't work. I think it actually hasn't really worked for him in the past 5 years or so. But I still enjoy him. And of course, he was the, you know, for 90s kids, he is the original romantic hero. Right. So there's a lot of fondness there, I would say.
Yeah, absolutely. He makes some of the, I think, I don't watch a lot of indie cinema because those of you that have listened to my show, I've expressed this before, I don't really like movies just in general. Like, I just have a hard time sitting through them. But out of the ones I've seen, I would say I've probably appreciated Aamir Khan movies the most as movies. But Shah Rukh Khan does have that nostalgic energy that he brings. Like, it's not the 90s without Shah Rukh Khan, without Kuch Kuch Hota Hai, without DDLJ, right, without all of those movies that were just part of how we grew up.
Exactly.
And so transitioning a bit over from the wonderful world of Bollywood to this book that you chose, and I was shocked, honestly. So this book, I have to preface this by saying, when I first asked you to be on the show and I talked about picking a favorite book, and for a lot of my guests, you know, picking one favorite book is so challenging, and I appreciate that. It's so hard to pick a favorite. And then you kind of broached the question of, do you want a book that I just really, really love? Or do you want a book that we could really dig into and make good conversation about? And I was really intrigued by that question. And I was glad you went with the latter with this book, because there's so much to discuss here. And so for those of you that have never heard of this book, which I imagine is most of my audience, because it was a struggle to try to find information on this book, this is called Shadow of the Moon by MMK. It's a historical novel, first published in 1956, and then it was later revised in 1979, and we'll talk about why that is a bit later. It takes place in British India right around the time of the 1857 mutiny, and it follows our main female lead, Winter de Ballesteros, who is a half-Spanish, half-English heiress raised in India, and then returned to the country to marry a commissioner in the army. It's this like big sprawling historical novel. It's got about 5,000 characters. It's not usually the kind of book I gravitate towards, but I found it really, really interesting. But I have to start by asking you, you know, how did you find this book? What were your first impressions of it? Like, take me back.
Okay, so this is actually a book that was recommended to me by this woman that I call grandma, but she's not really related to me. She's actually married to one of my dad's best friends. Mm-hmm. And it's interesting because I never really put it together until years later. But she is Anglo-Indian, and mm-hmm. she comes from an army family. Her dad was in the army, and her grandfather was in the army. She married an army man, her kids in the army, her granddaughter's in the army. And I never really thought about it in that lens, you know, like as an Anglo-Indian whose family was an army family. I never really put it in those terms. But she recommended that I try and read The Far Pavilions, which is the most famous book that MMK wrote. Mm-hmm. And it was adapted. I believe there is a there's a version of the miniseries of The Far Pavilions with Amy Irving playing this half-Indian princess, which is very mm-hmm. funny to me. And I read The Far Pavilions and I really didn't care for it. I didn't think it was a very good book. And then I heard about this book and I needed to read it because I am a completist, or I used to be a completist. I've grown out of it. But I went and I found this book and I immediately fell for it like a ton of bricks, or, you know, mm-hmm. something immense and weighty. And so I love mid-20th century Anglo-American fiction. Like, that's my jam. I love mm-hmm. The Blacklist. I think it's a pity and a shame that people don't really read that kind of literature anymore. And I can see why, you know, like, A, it's old and nobody wants to read things that are old, and B, some of it is problematic, and we'll come to that in this book. Yeah. But it's really well written, you know, like it's got a great pace to it. And I'm not intimidated by the size of it or the cast of characters, because again, I'm Indian. I'm used to that kind of epic yep. storytelling. Mm-hmm. So I really, really loved it. And I was way too young to read it. I was like probably like 12 or something when I first read it. And There was a lot of things that I think I have come to understand about this book in retrospect through rereads and things. But I remember reading it for the first time, and I remember very clearly thinking, I have never heard even about some of the things that are being described in this book. And that's because it's a very specific lens. It's an Anglo-Indian lens at the history of the British Empire in India.
Mm-hmm.
And you don't usually get to see that. You get to see the Indian version of the Indian history of the British Empire. You get to see the British version. And I think the Anglo-Indian version usually gets folded into the British version. But it was really interesting to me even then. And I didn't grow up thinking about race and things like that, but it was still interesting to me to read the way that Winter considered herself to be Indian. And mm-hmm. later on to find out that it sort of reflected MMK's own feelings about her identity. And it's just, you know, it's just a good story too. Like, I don't know, I found it very romantic as a tween, very angsty, and it has a good pace to it. So it was all things that I really enjoyed.
Yeah, I agree with so much of this. I really thought the question of identity here was really interesting, and that kept me sort of invested in this story because it does bring some nuance to the colonialist narrative. And so to flesh out what you were saying about Winter, so basically Winter, as I described her, she's half Spanish, half English, but she was raised for much of her life in India, born in India, raised in India, only moved to back to England when she's about 11 years old, I believe, or just young, okay. When she's young, but she speaks the language fluently. She really grows up believing India is her home and that she'll return to her home. And this is really where she's most comfortable. And I found myself comparing this at first to a book like maybe The Good Earth by Pearl S. Buck, mm-hmm. which, you know, Pearl S. Buck was living in China, you know, that's just the land she called home at the time, but she was writing about Chinese characters. And I think this book does one better because it's not trying to co-opt the opinions of Indians the way she did in the Good Earth, you know, writing a story mm-hmm. about Chinese people. It is specifically a book about people like MMK and their lens on the mutiny, their lens on India. And so there is that level of authenticity that this book has. I mean, it doesn't make it not problematic, which we're going to dig into, but it does give it a certain interesting nuance.
I think what I really connected to was this idea of, you know, it was the first time that I had read a perspective by a British white person who considered themselves to be Indian.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, there's a line of thought that the way that non-white people come to America and consider themselves to be American,
right.
Just based on their citizenship, that is kind of seen as revolutionary and it's the first time that's ever happened in the history of the world, etc. But I honestly don't think that's true. I think that is something that has happened in empires throughout history. It's happened in the Roman Empire. It's happened in the British Empire. And I'm from Delhi. Like, I grew up in Delhi. And we grew up on the songs of this one particular poet in the 12th century who was born to a Persian family in India. And he considered himself to be Indian. And, you know, even today we sing his songs, we, you know, remember him at the shrines of the saints that he followed. He was a Sufi. Mm-hmm. And I remember thinking about that when I was reading this book for the first time and then in subsequent readings and thinking that is true. Like, you don't really need to be of the blood to belong to the soil. And that was something that just really, that really connected to me, even at a young age.
Yeah, I absolutely agree with that. And I was coming back to, you know, the United States context, because obviously, you know, you do think of that as like unique to the United States in a way, you know, the idea of a melting pot or a salad bowl, so to speak, of all these different people coming and finding a new nationality. But you're right, this has existed since the beginning of time. And especially if you look at India, it's comprised of so many different ethnic groups that mm-hmm. found their way to India in so many different ways. You have the Mughals, you have the Persian influence, you have all these different groups that have come to India. But now if you look at India, I mean, you see a brown face and you're like, they're all Indian. Obviously, there's more nuance to it than that. But there are a variety of different ways that you can consider yourself a national of a country. And we're kind of made to show that Winter is Indian. I mean, I don't think it's, mm-hmm. you know, revolutionary to say that she's not at home in the West. Like, we see that throughout. She sees herself as Indian. And it's very interesting as this book progresses and the violence sort of increases, Winter gets more and more comfortable. Mm-hmm. She kind of changes her dress and kind of changes to Indian dress, wears her hair in the Indian way that she grew up wearing her hair. And she just feels more at home, even when things around her are, you know, turmoil for people like her. Like, she realizes she can't go back. This is her home.
Right. And that was really powerful to read as well. You know, like, she, the sense of connection that she feels to that particular place in her life. And it's not even just India as a whole, you know, it's just that room in which she was born and she was raised for a great many years. And she sees it as a talisman, and she sees it as the core of her identity. And you were talking earlier about Perlis Buck and about how this isn't as appropriating. And I agree, like, you know, it's not, it doesn't have that weird, like, you know, like, I'm white, but also I'm going to just take this culture. Like, it doesn't have that feeling about it. It's very authentic, you know, like, a Winter doesn't exoticize the world that she's in when she's in India. She doesn't feel as if she has ownership of it, or as if she, you know, they owe something to her. She just sees herself as part of it, and she acts like it. That's all she does. You know, she's just like, well, I'm here and I belong here, and this is how I'm going to live. And it's wonderful.
Yeah. And I think even though Winter doesn't do that, some of the other characters, you know, they definitely exoticize India. And sometimes, you know, reading some of the prose that MMK writes, where it's like, ooh, look at the jungles and the wildness of India. Or my least favorite thing is, like, describing Indian women as like, oh, because they're Eastern, they sexually matured a lot faster. And I'm like, I hate that trope so much. And that is definitely here.
So I don't know how familiar you are with MMK, but she is she's a real character. So as I said, like, you know, she based this entire book based on the diaries kept by her, I want to say her great uncle, and who was serving in the British Army during this particular period in history. So he actually lived through the mutiny, or as Indians call it, the First War of Independence. Right. And he provided, I think, the most complete first-person account of what happened in Delhi, for example, which was just horrific, you know, like, not just the siege by the Indians, but then what the British did to the Indians when they reclaimed the city. You know, there was murder and rape and pillage. And he was one of the people who just really put it all down in his diary. So for people who don't know, you know, the military diaries of the 19th century British officers who were serving all across the empire, they're fascinating. And, you know, they've been adapted into other books before. Most notably, I think for me, has been The Spanish Bride by Georgia Thayer, which is based on General Harry Smith's diaries, for example. So it's a weirdly personal story for MMK in many ways. And Kay herself, you know, she was a illustrator, and like other Anglo-Indian British kids, she was sent back to London to study, and she went to college here and everything. And then she eventually went back to India because her heart was there, and she met a married British army officer, fell in love with him, had his baby waiting for him to get a divorce. It was a huge scandal. And then married him, and then that was just in time for the British Empire to end and the Second World War to come to an end. And so then just followed him, you know, around the world because he was still being posted in other parts of the empire. And then it's kind of funny because she, after this, you know, she also wrote these murder mysteries. And mm-hmm. you can just follow the murder mysteries. And it's like, you know, like, this is where the British Empire used to be, and now it's not there. Next place, this is where the British Empire used to be, and now it's not there. And you just, like, follow them, like, you know, from place to place. So it's a very interesting life that she led, and she had some very interesting opinions about a great many things. And you kind of see that not just in her historical novels, but also in her murder mysteries. So yeah, if anyone out there is really interested in Kay, like, I would strongly suggest being a completist because she has a very interesting bibliography.
Yeah, and I had, like, briefly looked into her Wikipedia page a bit, and I had seen a few snippets of these things, but, you know, put all together, I was like, oh wow, that's a fascinating life. And I think the reason I had looked into her backstory is because I was so curious as to why this book was originally published in 1956 and then republished in 1979. And I looked into the story and I thought it was interesting, you know, the Far Pavilions, which you referenced before, that was like her big bestseller to a certain degree, like that allowed her to publish a second version of this book, which was actually her original telling of it. And the first draft of it, or the first version of it that was published in 56, you know, it took a lot of the action scenes out and she wanted those back in. And I'm so glad she did, because that was so compelling to me, the level of violence that she, that's why I was laughing when you said you read this at 12. There is so much violence in this book. Like, there is, like, beheadings and massacres and hoo boy.
Yeah. I mean, I was a very weird kid, to be fair. But yeah, so actually, you know, the most interesting thing to me about Kay is that years later, I read her book called Death in the Andamans. And this is tangential to the main discussion. So feel free to cut it out if you want.
We love tangents.
Okay. So Death in the Andamans is actually based on this little vacation that she took once. And she has this little author's note in the beginning where she describes, you know, a world that doesn't exist anymore, and she's lamenting it. And she's basically talking about this drink called a Tom Collins, which is a gin drink. And it, I guess, was invented in India during the British Empire. And the empire was basically fueled by it, by her account. And she talks about how you can't really find a good Tom Collins anymore. And her favorite memory of it was sipping on these in the garden of her friend's father, who was a jailer in the Andaman Islands. And that's all she says, you know, like, it was a very lovely period in her life. They used to just sit out in the garden in the evenings and drink Tom Collins's. And as a child, when I read it, and by child, I mean, like, probably I was in my teens at the time. I was like, oh, okay. And then I just went into the murder mystery, which is a good mystery, by the way. And years later, I was reading it again. And I read that author's note again, and suddenly something clicked in the back of my head. And I was like, oh my God, her friend's dad was a jailer in the Andamans. And as far as I'm aware, there's only one jail in the Andamans, and that's the cellular jail. And the cellular jail was the torture prison of the British Empire.
Oh no.
Like, it's literally a museum right now. Like, people, like, I think they had like a 30% suicide rate, and like others would be tortured to death, starved to death. Like, it was intense. Like, people would just die. And the people that survived it would come out and they would never talk about it again because it was so upsetting. I think there's only been like one person who ever wrote you know, of their experiences in that prison, and it sounds like hell on earth. And it was just, I was just like, oh my God, like, oh, I don't know what to do with this. Like, I don't think I can ever read that book again, because it was so blithe, you know. It was just like, oh, I used to sit in the garden of this jailer and like drink my lovely Tom Collins's, and right next door, people are being tortured to death. Like, oh my God.
Oh my God, that is horrifying. And
yes,
I think, you know, as much as we can talk about the nuance in this book, yeah, it's problematic. Like, there is no narrative written by white people about colonialism that isn't problematic. And I like that you're giving this element of history to this, because something that was occurring to me while reading this book is that, you know, growing up as Indian in the United States, you learn so little about Indian history in the US. Mm-hmm. And I was talking about this in last week's episode with Sanjana Sathyan. And she and I were talking about how in the US you kind of grow up, this is your version of Indian history. It's like, okay, the Indus Valley Civilization, and then a lot of years go by, and then colonialism, and then Gandhi shows up, and now here's India. Like, that's all you're given of Indian history. And I realized the only reason I knew about the 1857 mutiny / First War of Indian Independence, the only reason I knew about this ahead of time is because I read Amar Chitra Kadas. And that's where I learned about like the cartridges being greased with fat, and about like the rebellions, and then the Rani of Jhansi, who isn't in this book. I wish he was. It's a different part of India. But those kinds of things were coming up. And I was like, how are comic books the only reason I know about this?
But it's also interesting to me, because I was, this was the first time that I read the British version of the events. You know what mm-hmm. I mean? Like, I... obviously, like, I'm Indian. I grew up in Delhi. I know the Indian version of everything that went down. And right. It was really helpful to me to just find out the other version of it, because we never really heard about the massacres carried out by the Indian former soldiers, or the rebels, right. as, you know, the British would call it. And I never knew about that. So this was the first time that I actually read about it. And then it put a lot of things in context. I feel like I understood things a lot more. But it's still interesting, you know, like to read about, say, Hodgson, who is described as Alec Randall. Alec Randall is the main lead in mm-hmm. this book. And he's described as, you know, his good friend. Sort of yep. like devil may care kind of buddy, who just shows up for a couple of scenes, and he's a real historical figure. So there are like a lot of real historical figures in this book, and they're presented very sympathetically.
Yeah.
And it's interesting to me to read that version and then read the actual things that they did as administrators and soldiers in India at the time, you know, the the corruption, the pillaging, the rapes, the murders, the massacres, like all of that. So it's really interesting to me to see what the British were thinking. And, you know, it's funny, like a long time ago, my dad told me that I should live in London or in the UK if I could. He didn't want me to move there permanently, but he was like, you know, if you can spend some time there, then you should, because you will understand so much more about India by just living there. And as a child, I was like, oh, what are you talking about, Daddy? Like, you know, the empire was a long time ago. Like, I don't think so. And then I moved to London, and I went to places in London that were, you know, built because of the East India trade, and were informed by colonialism. And you would see all these different historical perspectives, and you would see the way that, you know, that city was built, like London was built, and the statues that they've put up and the people that they glorify. And you think about your own history, and you think, wow, okay, so now I see what my father was talking about, you know, like walking into the Imperial War Museum, for example, in London, which is an excellent museum. And I would recommend everyone go there if they're in London. But you walk in there and they're talking about how the Commonwealth came to the aid of Britain during the World Wars. And they're talking about these volunteers in Australia and Canada. And I'm like, that's nice. But what about the millions, like literal millions of Indian soldiers who also volunteered and died for your war?
Yes.
You know, like that's just sort of like one little side note somewhere buried in the back. So it's interesting just to read things like this. And I understand why some people might dismiss it as, you know, imperial propaganda and stuff. But I think it's honestly really interesting to just see what people's mindset used to be and like how they approach it. And I think I would rather that people remember empire and discuss it than forget it absolutely, because I think that's a whole other problem.
Yes, I totally agree with that. And I mean, there's something to be said for, you know, the versions of history. There's his side, her side, and the truth, so to speak. And there's a middle ground between the different narratives you're getting, because we do see in this book that the Indian soldiers and the Indian people do commit atrocities. They kill women and children. There is butchering, and obviously they have reasons for their feelings, but I think we can all agree that the butchering of children is not okay. And it's very interesting to put that into perspective, especially with the characters that MMK creates. And I think that's where we can come to Alex Randall, who you mentioned, and he's kind of our main like male lead, so to speak, but he's also kind of a central character, because for a lot of this book, Winter just kind of doesn't show up, and it's focused on Alex and the various things he's doing in his military service. And I found his character really interesting because he definitely, you know, he has come to respect India to a certain degree. He's learned the language. He's gotten to know the people. And he outright says, you know, if I was a countryman of yours, I would understand what you're fighting for. And I understand it. But he still finds himself having to oppose it, because his version of it is, you know, if England leaves India alone, it'll just get taken by the Russians, which I thought was really interesting. Part of me was wondering, was that a real fear, or was this reflective of the Cold War era that MMK was probably writing in? But I don't know much about history to make that claim for sure, but he kind of justifies his presence in that way. But we do still see that the conflict does give him a lot of pause and a lot of introspection.
So the Great Game was actually a thing, and it extended into the Cold War. And I think you're not wrong in that those were probably things that Kay was experiencing at the time that she was writing it, and therefore that was reflected in it. But the Great Game was, again, one of the things that I discovered through this novel, because I was 12. I didn't really know that this was a thing. But I will also say that there's something that Alex Randall says in this book that has always stuck with me. And that is, you know, he and Winter are having this conversation about how India is an ancient civilization, blah, blah, blah. And he says, India is such a young country. And
yeah,
it was something that like really, really struck me when I read it. And it's never gone away. And he says that, you know, like what you are talking about, like there's a difference between a civilization and a country. And the country of India is something that was being cobbled together by the British. And I'd never really thought of it in that sense before. And then when he said it, I was just like, oh, I see. Okay. And that really spoke to me as an Indian, I think. And you're right. Like, you know, he is a complex character. I really like the fact that he was able to really, you know, it's funny because Winter identifies as an Indian, and she keeps talking about how it's her country and she loves it, and she loves the people. She understands the language, all that stuff. But I feel like of the two of them, Alex is the person who really understands India. Like, he understands the motivations of the people. He's one of the few people who can really understand the Indians that he encounters and what they must be feeling, and their motivations. And I think the great game stuff is not really what he is that interested in. I think he's just really committed to the land, the district that he is administering. And he's just like really good at his job, but he's also really fond of the people, I think.
Yeah, I think that's a great way of looking at it. And I came across that scene too, where he says India is a young country. And I was first, my first instinct was like, no, it's not. Like, India's been around forever. But then I realized, you know, India as the concept as a country is new. And I mean, we think of that too as how long has India even been independent? 1947. Mm-hmm. That seems a while ago, but like my grandparents were alive in British India. Like,
right.
That's not that long ago. People still remember partition. People remember independence. This is not ancient history. And so I think just the idea of India as a country by our maybe Western standards, that is new. And sort of as a united front, but as a civilization, obviously, like you're saying, way, way older than all these other civilizations.
And I think he also, you know, like, it's interesting because this particular book, when you compare it to, say, The Far Pavilion. So The Far Pavilions, for people who haven't read it, it's a lot more exotic. And I think that might be the reason why it actually performed better upon release than this book, because there was a great appetite at the time for this kind of like British Empire, you know, Sunny Days of the Raj kind of novel. Everybody loves a good princess story too, you know. So there's a young English officer who is going to like save this young princess from committing sati. I mean, it's a very old trope.
Yeah.
I can see why the British really loved it and everybody wanted to adapt it. But it's also the more inferior work because it doesn't really engage with India in a very serious manner, in my opinion. Like the Afghan war parts of it, I think, are really well done. But in general, I don't think it's as well done as this particular book because this one is really about the bigger picture.
Yeah.
So it's not really just about like these two people and their, you know, their agonies over each other. It's also about like all these other things that are happening on a macro level. And that's really interesting to me.
And I'm so glad you brought up sati in this context because that comes up in this book. And I found the parallels were really interesting here because we see obviously there are a couple of things that the British are known for like trying to end in India. One of them being, you know, the abolition of sati, and another thing being, you know, child marriage. They thought that was like a barbaric practice. But then it's so interesting looking at it with this book when Winter is literally betrothed to this much older man when she's like 11 years old. And I'm like, that's child marriage. And then similarly, during the conflict, there's a man who is killed. I'm not going to say who for spoiler reasons, but there's a man who's killed and his wife is literally like trying to go to him and she's held back. And it completely mirrors the scene of Alex trying to hold a woman back from sati. And it just, this contrast is so interesting because it's like, what are you doing? Like, obviously nowadays, these are not the best practices. We know this, but the British were still doing this themselves.
And I think that was deliberate. Like, I feel like Kay knew enough about the British and about India, and she understood that particular hypocrisy. I mean, there's a reason why a lot of 19th century British literature resonates so deeply with so many Indians, because there's a lot of stuff in there that you're just like, well, that's just us, but in, you know, uncomfortable clothes. So, you're right. It is pretty interesting and funny.
It is. And I think, you know, talking about Alex, back to Alex is, you know, you're tempted to see him as kind of this romantic figure. And he kind of is in a certain way. I mean, I think you also have to compare him to the other men we have in this book, who are all terrible. All of them. They're all awful. And so by comparison, Alex literally looks like your knight in shining armor.
when I read this book for the first time, I was just beginning to think about boys and things. And mm-hmm. Alex really had a deep influence on what I find attractive in men, because I really think of like them being A, not terrible, and B, just being good at their job as like really attractive. Yeah. I'm like, wow, an efficient human being who is right. like cheating and murdering and raping and, you know, just being just awful all the time. Like, that's great.
And it's so funny because, like, obviously if you're talking about competency at the job and you're comparing someone like Alex to Conway, who is just the worst human being on earth, like, spoilers, everyone, he's terrible. But it got me wondering, you know, is this considered a romance or is it more of a historical novel? And I honestly feel like the romance in this book is not the main focus, especially in this version with all the action scenes still in it. And I think that actually makes the book more interesting, the fact mm-hmm. that it's trying to be more of a historical retelling mm-hmm. and less of like a, oh, doomed couple in the British Raj, India, and you know, not playing into those tropes as much. I think it's stronger by having the romance elements more understated.
I agree. I wouldn't have enjoyed it as much. You know, I'm again referencing a book that you haven't read, but The Far Pavilions is a lot more invested in the romantic relationship between the two mm-hmm. characters, and I really didn't enjoy that at all.
Yeah, and I completely agree with that. And I guess before we talk about other books and recommendations, I want to close out with one big thought. And so the idea of, can we write literature like this today? And the reason I bring that up is, so recently there was a book published that's gotten quite a lot of press, negative and positive. And it's a book called Meet Me in Bombay by Jenny Ashcroft. I'm not sure if you've encountered this book. I haven't read it myself, but it's basically this, it's written by a white person, and it's this book that takes place in colonial India, and it's like this epic love story within the setting of the British Raj and all that, and, you know, World War I is coming and all that stuff. That's kind of the time period it takes place in, so a little after this, and the book has just been slammed, especially by Indian and Indian American reviewers, just by saying like, you can't write a book like this anymore. Like, what are you doing? Like, do you feel that a narrative like this is very of its time, or is there a way you can write this today?
Oh, it's interesting because I have thought about this, not because of this particular book that you're mentioning, but just in general, because I was thinking about whether I would enjoy this book if I had encountered it as an adult. And if I would have enjoyed it if I had read it today, you know, because, you know, I was 12 a very long time ago. So we're talking about a dramatically different India and world than we are talking about today. So I think probably it is a thing of its time.
Yeah.
I think there is probably a way to do this, like this kind of story. And you would have to do it pretty much the way that Kay did it, in that, you know, it's about two white people and it is taking, you know, the historical context into account and centering that rather than them as much. But mm-hmm. I also feel like it is probably more difficult to do that, because when we are writing about history from a fictional standpoint, then it becomes more difficult to take a neutral tone, you know?
Yeah.
So especially when the characters are related to the oppressor nation or race, as it might be. So if you're talking about like two British people who are in, you know, any part of the British Empire, you're going to be talking about the way that they experience it and how they interact with it. And it would honestly be anachronistic for them to be like, oh, I support, you know, independence for these people, even as I am the administrator for these people. Like, that is not something that is going to happen. Like, even if it does happen, it would be somebody like Alex who is like, yes, all right, I see why you deserve independence, but also we have to consider the great game or like these other things, you know?
Yes, I think I agree with that perspective. When I was thinking about this, I was thinking like, well, you know, are certain topics just off limits these days? And I'm like, I don't think so, but I feel like these days the discussion about colonial and post-colonial literature has changed irreparably, and I would argue for the better. Like, we are valuing own voices stories more than ever before. And I would just say, just in general, like, people are less interested in two white people falling in love in colonial India and more interested in a story probably from an Indian perspective, or at least with a more nuanced perspective. Whereas a book like this just kind of, by premise alone, like I said, I haven't read it, feels tone deaf.
Yeah, I haven't read it either. I saw it floating around, but I haven't read it. And I don't think I will, actually.
Yeah, it's not really my cup of tea. I just saw that premise and the title to the Meet Me in Bombay. I was like, oh no. Like, I get a vibe just from the title. And so, Amrita, before we close out today, you've mentioned some other books in our discussion, but I'd love to hear, are there other books you would recommend for people maybe interested in this either time period or in literature about this time, or just books in general that you'd recommend?
I don't think there is a lot of like fiction set around this time. Like, I tend to read more nonfiction. And it tends to be things like famine and genocide and, you know, just really good books. But I don't think that it's a natural transition from reading something like Shadow of the Moon to that. I will say that if you like the mid-20th century kind of books, and if you like this book, like if you read this book and you enjoyed it, then I would really recommend the novels of Mary Stewart, who writes murder mysteries, and they're romantic murder mysteries, a little bit light on the romance, but just really well written. And I always think of her and MMK as being peers in that sense, because Kay's murder mysteries are also of a similar tone. Let me think. Historical fiction. Oh, I wish you had asked me this before, because I would have probably like thought it through.
I always tell my guests that I'm going to ask this question ahead of time, and then I never do, but that's my poor planning.
I'm just trying to think of like who else I like in terms of historical fiction. For some reason, like when you ask me for recommendations, all I can think about are murder mysteries. I'm just thinking of
this. We love murder mysteries.
There's this other murder mystery series that's set in 19th century Regency England. And it's called the Sebastian Sincere series. Sincere as in ST period CYR, which is one of the best puns that I've ever come across in a name. And I am forever jealous that I didn't think of it first. But the Sebastian Sincere series is a murder mystery series, and it's really remarkable in that it really talks about the seedier side of London at the time, rather than, you know, the Bridgerton experience, which is all pretty clothes and pretty women and balls and dancing. So I guess all my recommendations are for murder.
You know what? We enjoy that too, because I couldn't come up with any similar recommendations either. I would just say, you know, for every colonialist book that you read, try to find another by an Indian author to balance it out. You know, there are multiple sides to history. And if this is a time period you're interested in, like, just try to do more reading from as many sources as you can, fiction, nonfiction, no matter what. I'm definitely trying to make up for my lack of knowledge of Indian history by trying to find, you know, fiction and nonfiction alike that just sort of immerses me more in a time period. So this was definitely, you know, part of that. And I'm excited to find more. It's just, Oh, go ahead.
If you are interested in Indian historical murders, I actually have a couple of recommendations. One of them is actually set in this exact time period too. And it's by, I think his name is Muzaffar Jung is a hero in the, it's called Murder at the Mushaira. And I don't know if, I don't know when it will be out in the United States, but it is set during the First War of Independence in Delhi. And the main character, the investigator in this, is actually one of India's greatest poets, Mirza Ghalib. And he has a murder to solve. And it's by this man called Raza Mir wrote it. And it's fantastic. I recommend it. And then there's also a series that is set during the reign of Shah Jahan. Shah Jahan was the Mughal emperor who built the Taj Mahal, for people who might know that better. And it's the Muzaffar Jung series by Madhulika Liddle, Liddle. Mm-hmm. And it's great. Like, it's, I think the first book in the series is called The Englishman's Cameo. And it's about this surprisingly cosmopolitan world, you know, in 17th century India. And it has murder. So that's great too.
Those sound so much fun. I'm definitely going to be looking to see, you know, when I can get my hands on those copies. Like, it's always so hard to get books published elsewhere in the United States, but I'm gonna hope, or at least call upon my connections in India and see if I can get my hands on those copies. But that sounds excellent. Amrita, thank you so much for your time and your insight and for introducing me to a book I never would have picked up on my own, but I was very happy to have read it. And before we close out, Amrita, can you tell us where we can find your podcast, your BookTube?
Sure. You can find my BookTube at Amrita by the Book. And it's on YouTube, it's on Instagram. And I also co-host the Khandan, a Bollywood podcast. And it is available on literally every platform that you can think of.
Same as this podcast, absolutely. So you can find both of those shows, you know, Spotify, Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, wherever you listen to shows like that. And definitely urge you to check out both Amrita's BookTube and the podcast, even if you're not a big Bollywood watcher, which I'm not. I think you'll still find a lot of joy in this, especially for my Indian American listeners. And you like those nostalgia movies as much as I do. Like, I know you do. So definitely check those out. And Amrita, thank you so much. This has been an absolute pleasure.
Thank you so much for having me on. Like, I never get to talk about books like these. I especially never get to talk about this book. So I really appreciate you not only inviting me on, but also reading it, because it's a chunky boy. So I really appreciate you.